Chapter 18. My aim is true. Spanish is the language of the early morning in Manhattan. At the bagel place where I get my coffee, everybody, customers and counter help alike, or Poppy, or Flaco, or Hermano, or addressed by country of origin. Doesn't matter if Spanish is even your language. At this hour, it's what's spoken. It's how things are done. The Bengali shop owner, the few American suits, everybody addresses each other in one form or another of Spanish. That's who's up and working this time of the morning, and who owns this part of the day. The doorman from the nearby apartment buildings, the porters, the nannies on the way to work, the construction guys sent out on a coffee run, the dishwashers and early arriving restaurant help. They greet each other with the familiar nicknames. If they don't recognize a face, they ask in Spanish, ¿Qué país? It's 7 a.m. in the chilly, white-tiled bowels of Le Bernardin in New York City, where the language is also Spanish, and Justo Thomas is looking at 700 pounds of fish. A stack of styrofoam crates packed with halibut, white tuna, black sea bass, mahi-mahi, red snapper, skate, cod, monkfish or salmon, mostly unscaled, on the bone, guts still in, reaches halfway up the wall of his tiny workspace. The way they catch, he explains, meaning on the bone, the way God made them, the way they came out of the ocean, and the way that Le Bernardin insists on receiving them. Shiny, clear-eyed, pink-gilled, still stiff with rigor and smelling of nothing but seawater. Everybody from outside the restaurant, the constant procession of delivery men who bring cases of wine, vegetables, langoustines, octopus, uni, dry goods. They call him primo, first, or number one, which seems to please Justo. Le Bernardin is probably the best seafood restaurant in America. It's certainly the most celebrated. 3 consecutive 4-star reviews from the New York Times, 2-time winner of 3 Michelin stars, Zagat's best-rated restaurant in New York, every honor award you could imagine. The best by any measure of assessing such things. Which means they don't cut fish at Le Bernardin like other restaurants. The standards are, to say the least, different. Expectations for a hunk of protein are higher. Justo is from the rural Dominican Republic. He was the middle brother of 3 in a family of 7 kids, 5 sisters. His father was a farmer, growing coffee and coconuts. The family raised a few pigs for sale and chickens for the table. As a child, Justo went to school, then helped on the farm after. His first job was as counter help at his uncle's pastry shop, 6 a.m. until 10 p.m. every day. He never learned to bake. He's now 47 years old, and he's been working in New York City restaurants for 20 years, first under conditions of questionable legality, but quickly thereafter as a permanent resident and then as a citizen. He's got 3 kids, the eldest, a 20-year-old, in college. At Le Bernardin, he makes a flat salary that would be considered spectacular by industry standards, an amount in the neighborhood of what I made in my best years as a chef. Like all employees of the restaurant, he has full medical coverage. Once a year, he takes a 4-week vacation back in the DR. Unusually for the restaurant business, Justo has no set hours. He leaves whenever he feels like it, which is when he's done. He came to Le Bernardin 6 years ago, having heard good things about it when he worked across the street at Palio. They didn't even say good morning, he says, shaking his head. The chef treat everybody the same, he says proudly, adding that he'd been looking for some place with job security. I don't like to jump around. And at Le Bernardin, unlike almost every other job in the restaurant industry, I work by myself. In fact, Justo Thomas enjoys a degree of autonomy unheard of by his peers. The room where he works is actually a 10-foot-by-5-foot dogleg off the hallway through which deliveries are dragged or wheeled from the underground loading dock of the Prudential building on 51st Street. Justo works right next to the stewards Fernando's tiny office a few feet from the service elevator to the upstairs kitchen. He's got 1 work table covered with cutting boards, a shelf stacked with clear plastic Lexan storage trays, a child-sized overhead shelf where he keeps a small electronic scale and some needle-nose pliers. At the other end of the room is a 2-basin sink. The walls, curiously, have been carefully covered with fresh plastic cling wrap, like a serial killer would prepare his basement, to catch flying fish scales and for faster, easier cleanup. The plastic will come down, of course, at the end of the shift. Justo likes things clean and organized. Each prepositioned plastic tray has been fitted with a drainage rack so that the fish are raised up out of any liquid, and each rack additionally wrapped in cling wrap. Cousteau's knives, a not particularly expensive slicing knife, usually intended for carving roasts, a cheap stainless steel chef's knife, a severely ground-down flexible fillet knife, barely a half-inch left of blade, and another personally customized mutation with a serpentine edge, are laid out in a row at knee level on a clean side towel. Hanging on a nail behind him, there's a roll of bright red labels reading Wednesday, which he will use on each and every tray of fish he cuts today so the cooks upstairs know at a glance which portions to use first and from whence they came. He wears a bright yellow dishwashing glove on his left hand as he doesn't like to actually touch the fish. Cousteau Thomas, one notices quickly when observing him, is something of a germaphobe. One gets the impression very quickly that the concept of cross-contamination has made a powerful, even terrifying impression on him. When he wipes down his cutting board with a wet cotton side towel, he throws the towel away, every time. He is a man set in his habits. He has organized his time and his space the way he likes them. He has a routine, a certain way he likes to do things, and he never deviates. With Cousteau, says Le Bernardin chef Chris Muller, just arriving for work, it's all about no wasted motion. In a buckaroo bonsai-like explanation of the universe, wherever you go, there you are, Muller holds up one hand flat representing a fish in Cousteau land and says, it's here, then turns the palm over like flipping a page, and then it's there. He holds my gaze for a split second, as if I should understand that he's just revealed something profoundly important. Every sous chef, line cook, pâtissier, and stagiaire who walks by Cousteau on the way from the locker rooms stops, smiles admiringly, and says, good morning, chef, which is the way it's done at Le Bernardin. Courtesy is a matter of policy. One says good morning to all of one's colleagues, regardless of position, addressing each and every one as chef. Everyone who passes by and sees me standing there with a notebook in hand has to linger for a second to determine if I've gotten it yet. How phenomenally, amazingly, supernaturally fucking good Cousteau Thomas is at doing this job. They appreciate this better than I ever could because when Cousteau goes on vacation, it will take three of them to cut the same amount of fish that Cousteau alone will scale, gut, clean, and portion in 4 to 5 hours. It's not just that one man will cut 700 pounds of fish today and 1,000 pounds Friday and do the same more or less every day, day after day after day, but that every single portion must be perfect. He is well aware of what's at stake. Every piece, it's the chef's name, he says. He's not overstating the case. At Le Bernardin's level of success and visibility in the fine dining firmament, it is no exaggeration to say that were a single order of monkfish to smell even slightly off to hit the table, the result could explode across the internet like a neutron bomb. The scrutiny of a place of Le Bernardin's particular long-standing preeminence atop the high wire is ferocious. There are all too many people ready upon hearing of even one such incident to declare the restaurant not as good as it used to be or over, terms that are, for better or worse, the currency of influential food nerdism. Let's put it another way. I graduated from the best culinary school in the country. I spent 28 years as a professional cook and chef. I've cleaned and portioned thousands and thousands of fish in my time. The executive chef partner of Le Bernardin, Eric Repair, is probably my best friend in the world, and I would never dare to put a knife to a piece of fish at Le Bernardin. Repair maintains an unofficial intelligence network that would be the envy of the CIA solely for the purpose of defending the realm. If you're a food critic, a person of importance, anyone who could possibly hurt or impact the restaurant in a negative way, you are recognized within seconds of walking in the door. Your likes and dislikes are known. Even if you're a journalist who's never been in the restaurant but are likely to visit soon and write about it, chances are you will not, on arriving, be a completely unknown quantity. Repair is an astonishingly plugged-in guy. Point is, he has to be. So, Cousteau's not being disingenuous when he says he identifies each piece of fish with the name and reputation of his chef. That, at that level of fine dining, is the system, where every server, every cook, has to look at every little detail as having the potential to bring down the temple. Everything, absolutely everything, must be right, always. If you're Justo Thomas and you cut and portion fish for a living, you find it's necessary to do things in a certain order. He works in the same unvarying progression every day. Fernando, who receives and weighs the fish, always arranges it in the same order and configuration, the way Justo likes it. I like fish, says Justo without a trace of irony. I eat a lot of fish. He does not feel the same way about meat. He doesn't like it. I don't trust the blood, he exclaims, almost shuddering at the thought. I get cut, the blood get in me. Fortunately, he's not required to touch the stuff often. Perhaps out of sensitivity to Justo's phobia, the one beef dish on the menu, a Wagyu beef surf and turf, is portioned by the line cooks. Today, halibut comes first. It's one of the easiest fish to clean. Two fat, boneless fillets, top and bottom on each side. You zip them off the central spine easily. The skin comes off in one go, and the meat portions itself, like cutting filet mignon off a tenderloin. A 25-pound halibut takes Justo about 8 minutes. Cod is a different matter. It's delicate, extremely delicate, and perishable. The flesh, handled roughly, will mash. The physiognomy of a cod is not suited to eventual portioning as the identical, evenly shaped squares or oblongs a 3-star restaurant requires. But before I'm even fully aware of what's going on, Justo's got the fillets off the bone neatly stacked. He puts all the left side fillets in one stack, the right side fillets in another. With the inappropriate, one would think, slicing knife, he's drilling out absolutely identical cubes of cod, all the left-hand fillets first, then the right-hand ones. If they're not identical, he quickly and almost imperceptibly squares them off, trims them down to uniform size and shape. The trimmings form a steadily growing pile off to the side, which will be joined throughout the morning by other trimmings for eventual donation to City Harvest. Tail ends are smaller but still useful bits, doomed to never be uniform but in every other respect perfectly good, form another pile, above and away from the uniform ones. After he finishes one stack, he lays them out in a plastic tray in the order that they came off the fish. When the uniform, cookbook-quality left-hand sides and right-hand sides of fish have been arranged, never stacked on top of each other in the plastic tray, he pulls down the little gram scale from the shelf above him and at supernatural speed starts pairing up oddball pieces. He needs only weigh one piece for reference. The scale goes back to its shelf, and he squares off and pairs up the remaining pieces of cod, segregating them to the side in the tray. These will be used either as two separate orders for a tasting menu or artfully positioned on plates as whole orders. The point of segregating them from the others is that when the cooks have two or more orders of cod for the same table, it will be easy for them to ensure that all the plates will look the same, either two smaller pieces of cod or one brick. The whole system is designed for uniformity and ease, under worst-case scenario circumstances. The user, after all, is presumably a very busy line cook in a hurry. When Justo's done loading the cod, he covers the portions with plastic wrap, slaps a bright red Wednesday label on top, covers that with the clear plastic lid. He puts the scraps of cod for City Harvest on a small plastic wrap-covered sheet pan below the work table. He wipes down his station completely with hot water, presses the button for the elevator, washes his knives and hoses out the sink, knowing that he has just enough time to do this while the elevator to the a la carte kitchen comes down, not wanting to waste a minute waiting. Then he takes the tray upstairs, opens the walk-in, and places the tray on the shelf in the same exact place that the cod of the day has always been placed and always will be placed. The cooks will be able to find it blindfolded if necessary. Le Bernardin is a seafood restaurant, and we are hip-deep in the stuff. Ice from the fish crates is melting onto the floor, and Justo is even now hauling an enormous mahi onto the cutting board. But it does not smell of fish in this place. There is not even the vestigial smell of seafood you get at even the best wholesalers or Japanese fish markets. The fish is exquisitely fresh. Fernando is constantly mopping around and below us, every few minutes with hot, soapy water. Full crates come in, empties are dragged out, an ongoing process, almost organic. It reminds me of the opening passages of Zola's Belly of Paris, a supply train of horse carts laden with food stretching from market into the countryside and beyond. Any piece of fish you were likely to see at your supermarket or fishmonger's would be sniffed out and thrown away immediately here. If it smells like fish, it goes back, says Justo. Fish obtained from regional sources is sent back if deemed inferior in any way. Fish from a high-end wholesaler in Maine is simply weighed and thrown out if not up to standards. They reimburse without question. He attacks the mahi with his chef's knife, taking the fillets off with two strokes. Elapsed time, 60 seconds. Left side fillet goes to one side, right side to the other. By 8:15 in the morning, Justo has finished the day's portions of halibut, cod, and mahi. It's time for the skate, a fish he's not so fond of. He empties a big bag of large wings into the sink, about 35 pounds in all, and immediately starts washing them with cold water. Skate are slimy, delicate, highly perishable, and loaded with transparent bits of cartilage which, if left inadvertently inside, could do serious damage to the inside of your mouth or throat. Picture an airplane with fat wings. Top side of each wing is a thick fillet. On the underside, another thinner one. The perimeters of each wing bristle with little bones, and between the top and bottom fillets is a barrier of thin, flexible, dangerously translucent, cartilaginous spokes like the buttress of a church, and about as unpleasant to bite into. Justo picks up the chef's knife. I sharpen myself once a week. I can't help asking, once a week? For a guy as scrupulous as Justo, that seems like a long time to go between sharpenings. Cooks much less conscientious than he labor over their blades on a daily basis. The very essence of knife maintenance, a notion inextricably tied up with one's self-image as a cook, is that the sharper the knife, the better. Not necessarily, explains Justo. I like medium sharp, he says, pointing out the cartilage of the skate as an extreme example of his principle. Too sharp, you get part of the bone. When it's sharp and correct, it passes over the bone. With this, he grabs a large skate with his gloved hand and with the chef's knife removes the fattest part of the flesh from the top of both wings. It looks like he's savagely and indifferently hacking at the things. One skate after another, he quickly and brutally removes only the fattest part of the top of each wing. The rest, the two unexploited fillets on the underside of each fish, go straight in the garbage, along with about 70 to 80% of the total body weight of the animal, skin, bone, and cartilage. One could be forgiven for asking about City Harvest, an organization with whom Eric Repair works very closely and actively raises a lot of money. Why don't they take that fish? It's complicated, I gather. Simply put, and I'm guessing this is true across the board in similar fine dining restaurants, there's nobody and no place and no time to winnow out every scrap of fish from every carcass, or even most of them. Even the most good-hearted restaurants just can't do it. City Harvest does not, it appears, have the facilities or the personnel to transport, hold, process, and prepare the more close-in leavings of New York seafood restaurants. Fish, like skate, are, in any case, so extremely perishable that they'd likely be spoiled by the time any secondary team could get a knife to them. The way things work now, they don't even like to take the incredibly high-quality filet meat that Le Bernardin generates unless it's fully cooked first. The restaurant boils or steams the stuff before City Harvest takes it away. They claim it makes the truck smell bad otherwise. It occurs to me that a worthwhile endeavor for a charitable organization might be the creation of a flying squad of ex-convict or ex-substance-abusing trainee fish butchers who could pick up and quickly trim out every scrap of usable fish from contributing restaurants. They could probably feed a whole hell of a lot of people. If perishability is a problem, perhaps they could quickly puree the stuff on site, prepare and freeze Asian-style fish balls and fish cakes by the thousands. Note to self, talk to Eric about this idea. What's left of Justo's work on the mountain of skate are two large piles of perfectly bone-free pieces of fish. One side, then another, Justo removes the skin with the flexible blade at a 45-degree angle, trims off any and all blood or pink color that remains, and evens off the shapes with the slicer into the appropriate thicknesses and dimensions. Most fish, like skate wing, naturally taper off and narrow at the outer edges and toward the tail, which is fine for moving through the water. Not so good for even cooking. A chef or cook looks at that graceful decline and sees a piece of protein that will cook unevenly, will, when the center or fattest part is perfect, be overcooked at the edges. They see a piece of fish that does not look like you could charge $39 for it. Customers should understand that what they are paying for in any restaurant situation is not just what's on the plate, but everything that's not on the plate. All the bone, skin, fat, and waste product which the chef did pay for by the pound. When Eric Repair, for instance, pays $15 or $20 a pound for a piece of fish, you can be sure the guy who sells it to him does not care that 70% of that fish is going in the garbage. It's still the same price. Same principle applies to meat, poultry, or any other protein. The price of the protein on the market may be $10 per pound, but by the time you're putting the cleaned, prepped piece of meat or fish on the plate, it can actually cost you $35 a pound. And that's before paying the guy who cuts it for you. That disparity in purchase price and actual price becomes even more extreme at the top end of the dining spectrum. The famous French mantra of use everything by which most chefs live is not the operative phrase of a three-starred Michelin restaurant. Here, it's use only the very best. The rest, you do what you can. Justo pairs off the last irregular bits of skate, draping one atop the other. He catches one he doesn't quite like, a nearly imperceptible flaw. Most prep cooks in this situation would instinctively tuck the less beautiful one underneath a perfect one. Food cost, food cost, food cost. Not him. It's like wearing clean clothes with dirty underwear, he says, without a trace of humor. The unacceptable piece goes in the trash. It's only 8:45 and the skate are done. The table is washed again, knives too. The skate is brought upstairs. A large white tuna hits the cutting board next. He zips off the skin and shows me where there's a single, very soft, but hidden bone. Your knife too sharp, you cut through. You don't feel it. City Harvest is getting a lot of very expensive product off of this fish. Near the tail, Justo sees something he doesn't like and quickly carves off about a quarter of it. The fish is butchered as if for a sushi bar. No dark membrane, no raggedy bits. Center-cut filet only. He quickly breaks the thing down into four pristine hunks of loin. Then, without hesitating, divides those pieces into appropriate shapes for further slicing into medallions. At no other point during the day does he look so much like a machine. Uniform pieces of identical-looking portions fall away from his knife like industrially sliced bread. Lined up in the tray, they are the same size, weight, and height. He's almost apologetic about the huge pile of perfectly good tuna left on the board, rejected for its size rather than its quality. After trimming, it's probably costing the restaurant about $25 a pound. Hard to balance perfect and waste, he admits. 9:15, and Justo unloads an appalling heap of monkfish into the sink. Monkfish are one of the slimiest, ugliest creatures you'll find in the sea. They're also wonderfully tasty once you slip off the slippery, membrane-like skin and trim away the pink and red. This knife only for monkfish, says Justo, producing a long blade that might once have been a standard chef's knife, but which has been, over the years, ground down into a thin, serpentine, almost double teardrop edge. Once the monkfish meat is cut away from the bone, one loin at a time, he grabs the tail ends and runs the flexible blade down the body, pulling the skin away. With a strange flicking motion, he shaves off any pink or red. The quiet in the room is noticeable, and I ask him if he ever listens to music while he works. He shakes his head vigorously. For me, I like to concentrate. He says the distraction of music might cause him to cut himself, an outcome not so terrible for him, he suggests, but bad for the product. I don't want to get blood on the fish. I don't play around. I work fast because I work relaxed. I got nothing else on my mind. The monkfish is finished and safely stored upstairs at 9:40. There are two kinds of salmon to deal with now, one large wild salmon and 8 13-to-15-pound organically farm-raised salmon. Sustainability has become a major focus of Le Bernardin in recent years, and this particular farm-raised stuff is supposed to be very good. Justo prefers it. The organic, the farmed, is fatter, better raw. The wild, too much muscle for me, too much exercise. With the chef's knife, he cuts from collar down and lifts off the fillets. He peels a little bit of the meat that clings to the spine off one of the farm salmon and hands me a piece. It is indeed extraordinary. The skins are removed with a few rocking sweeps of the knife, but most remarkable is what he does with the pin bones. These are the tiny, tricky, nearly invisible little rib bones left in the meat when you take the fillets off the fish. They have to be removed individually by yanking the little fuckers out with tweezers or needle-nose pliers, a process that takes most cooks a while. Ordinary mortals have to feel for each slim bone lurking just beneath the surface, careful not to gouge the delicate flesh. Justo moves his hand up the fillet in a literal flurry of movement. With each bone that comes out, he taps the pliers on the cutting board to release it, then, never stopping, in one continuous motion, repeats, repeats, repeats. It sounds like a quick double-time snare drum beat, a staccato, tap, 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 and then, done. A pause of a few seconds as he begins another side of fish. I can barely see his hand move. I have never seen anything like it in nearly 3 decades in the restaurant business. With the slicer, he lifts the grayish meat that runs along the back straight away from the pink, a very delicate operation, which he, of course, accomplishes in seconds. One whole side of the wild salmon is put aside for the chef garde-manger. Justo lines a half-sheet pan with cling wrap, drapes the salmon on the tray, then wraps the whole tray under and over 3 times with one long piece of film. The fish is trapped in there as snug as if it were laminated. That way, if I fall down, says Justo, nothing going to happen to the fish. In about 2 minutes, all the remaining salmon are portioned in 75 to 80 gram slices. He hand checks each slice a second time by lightly pinching them as they're arranged side by side in the tray. Once in a great while, he feels a bony mist on the first pass and slips it out. 2 slices of salmon will constitute an order. Laid out end to end, all pointing the same direction, the slices themselves look like little pink fishes swimming upriver, identical patterns of fatty swirls running through their flesh. Lovely to look at, breathtaking in their uniformity. At 10:25, the salmon is on its way upstairs. A young cook, seeing me, asks eagerly, "Have you seen him do the pin bones?" "Yes," I say, nodding my head. "Yes, I have." "First time I heard it, I thought he was tapping his foot," says the cook. Justo grabs the first of 8 large striped bass out of a crate with thumb and middle finger hooked deep into the fish's eye sockets, not trusting the usual 2 fingers into the gills grab popular with fishermen. They're on their way upstairs by 10:45. Then it's 12 red snappers. It takes him 10 minutes to take all the snapper off the bone and remove their skins. Once again, left sides are put together in one stack, right sides in another. He shows me why. When cleaning the right sides, the knife has always to be drawn in one direction when cleaning membrane and trimming belly. The left sides, the blade is pushed away to perform the same tasks in the opposite direction. By sorting his fish as he does, Justo saves time and unnecessary movement. A half hour later, the snapper is done. Only a tremendous shitload of black sea bass, Justo's least favorite, remain. They are, for easily discernible reasons, the hardest fish to clean. Unlike much of what arrives, they are still covered with tough scales, guts still in, and bristling with nasty-looking and extremely dangerous spines. Fernando, the steward, comes by with Justo's staff meal, a rather forlorn-looking plate of chicken salad, dressed green salad and potato, with a bun. The plate is wrapped in plastic and placed unhesitatingly beneath Justo's workstation, as it has surely been agreed by unwavering routine and practice that Justo will wait to eat until he's finished with his work. He saved the worst until the end. At La Bernardin, fish is served without the skin, the black sea bass being the lone exception. Its skin is an important component of the final dish, adding vital textural and flavor notes as well as looking really cool. This means that one can't do simply a serviceable job of removing the scales, assuming that later any that remain will surely come off with the skin. Every single one has to be carefully scraped off in the sink, away from the cutting board. Justo is very conscious of the transparent scales' propensity to fly across the room and cling undetected to the white flesh of the fish. One transparent scale clinging to one order of fish, that would be bad. So he's got to carefully scrape off the scales, quickly, of course, avoiding the long and extremely vicious spines on the fish, which could easily penetrate his glove and inflict a painful and instantaneously infectious wound. Then fillet off the meat, remove the pin bones, which are even trickier and more reluctant to come out than those in salmon, trim, and portion. It is of tantamount importance for Justo when portioning to keep in mind the intended cooking method and result. A still moist, evenly cooked oblong of fish with a very crispy layer of skin on one side. If the piece of fish is too small, by the time the skin is crisped, the flesh is overcooked. Nature being what it is, no two fish are exactly the same, and the optimal size is not always available. It's up to Justo to make do. It's 12:10 in the afternoon, and Justo Thomas has finished cleaning and portioning 700 pounds of fish. He cuts a piece of cardboard from a carton and uses it to scrape out the fish scales from the sink. He hoses both basins down, washes his knives, the scale, and all exposed surfaces. He peels the cling wrap off the walls. He's done for the day. In 6 years at Le Bernardin and in 20 years cooking in New York restaurants, Justo Thomas has, like the overwhelming majority of people who cook our food, never eaten in his own restaurant. It's a central irony of fine dining that, unlike the waiters who serve their food, the cooks are very rarely able to afford to eat what they have spent years learning to make. They are usually not welcome in any case. They don't have the clothes for it. Many, if not most, expensive restaurants specifically prohibit their employees from coming as customers at any time. The reasoning is part practical and part, one suspects, aesthetic. One doesn't want a bunch of loud, badly dressed cooks laughing and talking in an overfamiliar way with the bartender while trying to maintain an atmosphere of sophistication, of romantic illusion. There is also the temptation to slip freebies to people one works with every day. From the point of view of any sensible restaurateur or manager, it's generally believed to be a bad thing. Once you let employees start drinking in their own place of work, even on their days off, you've unleashed the dogs of war. No good can come of it. Le Bernardin's rules reflect this industry-wide policy. But I figured I had some pull with the chef and asked him to make an exception. A short time later, I took Justo Thomas to lunch at his own restaurant. He arrives straight from his shift, having changed into a dark, well-cut suit and glasses with black designer frames, having left work by the service entrance and re-entered by the restaurant's front door. It takes a second for me to recognize him. He's nervous, but contained, and very happy to be here. He's dressed right for the room, but his posture and gait are not of a person who lives in spaces like this. His co-workers in the kitchen are excited for him, he says, scarcely believing this is happening, and the floor staff appear happy for him too, though they do their very best to conceal their smiles. From the very beginning, Justo's treated like any other customer and with the same deference. Led to our table, his chair pulled out, asked if he'd care to order from the menu or if he'd prefer the kitchen to cook for us. When wine arrives, the sommelier addresses her remarks to him. A little bowl of salmon rillettes is brought to the table with some rounds of toast. Champagne is served. Ordinarily, when Justo goes to dinner, he's with his family. They go to a roasted chicken place, or if it's a rare special occasion, to a Spanish restaurant for steak and lobster. When that happens, he does not drink at all. I am always the driver, he says. Though he is the middle brother, Justo has become, by virtue of his character and what he's achieved in New York, something of a patriarch. He owns a house in the Dominican Republic. He keeps the top floor for family use and rents out to tenants the first floor and an adjoining structure. His siblings tend to come to him for advice on important matters. His father, he says, taught him the lesson that one should never let your family be afraid while you're alive. He's the example for the rest, and he takes that responsibility seriously. Family first, then my job, he says. I'm enormously relieved when he takes his first sip of champagne, and when he tells me he will indeed be enjoying, along with me, the wine pairing to follow. The kitchen has insisted on doing a tasting menu for their favorite son, and one must, under such circumstances, drink wine. I was concerned earlier. Justo has said that his idea of getting really crazy on vacation is, in between working on his house, taking his family to the beach, buying pizza for his daughter, and maybe having a beer. On a perfect day, he'll dance with his wife. he will have arranged for a taxi to take them home. He's made similar arrangements today. The first course is tuna, layers of thinly pounded yellowfin layered with foie gras and toasted baguette. Justo enthusiastically cleans his plate with a critical eye. He recognizes his work, though the cooks have pounded it to paper thinness. It's a popular dish, and on the rare occasions when the dinner crew needs to pound more after he's gone for the day, he doesn't like it when they use his station. We're washing the tuna down with a Gelber Muscateller Neumeister from Austria. My cutting board is special, he explains. Justo handles only fish at Le Bernardin. Oysters, langoustines, prawns, and sea urchin are prepared upstairs in the a la carte kitchen. So though he's seen the pricey little boxes of plump orange sea urchin roes stacked neatly in even rows as he passed by, he's never eaten the stuff. We get a spiny shell each, the roe on beds of jalapeno wasabi jam, seasoned with seaweed salt, finished at the last second by our server, who pours wakame orange-scented broth over them. Kasumisuru Yamahai Gingo, says the sommelier, serving Justo sake. Delicious, says Justo, closing his eyes. It's like a dream. I don't want to wake up. The next course is seared langoustine with a salad of mash and wild mushroom with shaved foie gras and white balsamic vinaigrette, and it's one of the most goddamn delicious things I've ever put in my mouth. Small, elegant, lushly, but not overly rich. When I get out of here, I don't want to brush my teeth, he jokes, but I know exactly how he feels. You want to keep this taste. I lose track of the wines at this point. There are a lot of them, and a trilogy of ales, I think. Then more wines. But I do remember a bread-crusted red snapper with zucchini and mint compote coming our way, an extraordinary poached halibut with braised daikon, baby radish, and turnips, and a sesame court bouillon. You recognize your work, I ask? I point to the perfect squares of evenly shaped protein on our plates. Justo just nods and smiles, a look of satisfaction on his face. His last entree is the crispy black bass with braised celery and parsnip custard in an Iberico ham and green peppercorn sauce. It's the fish he likes least to work with, saves until last, the ever more popular labor-intensive fuckers that have to be gutted, scaled, filleted, rid of their resilient little pin bones, then squared off just right so the skin can get exactly this crispy without overcooking the meat. Justo looks particularly pleased to see his nemesis on the plate. Hopefully all his work now makes some kind of tangible sense. I find myself looking up at the enormous oil paintings on the dining room walls, scenes of fishermen and port towns in Brittany, or Maggie Lacoze, the founder and co-owner of Le Bernardin, along with her brother Gilbert, came from. Where it all started, and where the inspiration began for a fish-centric temple of seafood. I wonder what Justo would think of Brittany, and if he'll ever see it. I find myself wanting to make that happen. I ask him what he wants to do when he retires someday, and he answers me with the things he'll do when he goes back home, mostly involving repairs, improvements, work. But what about when the work is done, I ask, if things could be perfect? When I think everything is perfect, I think I'm going to get sick, he says. I'll think, what am I missing? What about the customers at Le Bernardin, I ask, referring to the older, obviously more comfortable patrons around us. Some of these people will spend more money on a single bottle of wine with dinner than even he, a well-paid man by most standards, will make in months. How does he feel about that? I think in life they give too much to some people and nothing to everybody else, he shrugs without bitterness. Without work, we are nothing. We linger over chocolate pot au creme and mascarpone creams and pistachio mousse. Not visibly affected by the generous pourings of wine, Justo orders an espresso, sits back in his chair, pleased. I got a good job, a good family. I live in peace.